voters overwhelmingly want medical marijuana in Florida. So why is it still facing legal challenges? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The debate over smokable medical marijuana is at the center of the most recent court battle. Now, the industry is growing, but the current election year is going to press the fight between the voters' desires and lawmakers' political positioning. Plus, does Miami need a long pedestrian path along the bay?
All of the waterfront belongs to the public and everyone should have access.
And how would life as an artist be different if you had an artist mentor give you advice back in high school? There's a program in Miami that does just that. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Well, voters overwhelmingly want medical marijuana in Florida. So why is it still facing legal challenges? Medical marijuana patients won't be able to smoke their pot in Florida, at least for the time being, because medical marijuana is in court right now. Medical marijuana is available for qualifying patients with certain conditions, but recently the Florida Appeals Court blocked a lawsuit claiming that patients should be allowed to legally smoke it. Its use is strictly edibles, oils, vaping, and sprays. Now, when medical marijuana passed in Florida on a constitutional amendment in 2016, it had 72% approval rating. But there have been a number of legal challenges, like the one recently I just mentioned. So here to talk about some of those is Dara Kam, senior writer for the News Service of Florida, who joins us via Skype. Dara, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
All right, tell us about last week's ruling and what does it do now?
So last week, the First District Court of Appeal here in Tallahassee, a three-judge panel, followed up on a ruling that they had given a couple of weeks prior to that, but they issued an opinion to flesh out their decision to refuse to lift a stay on a lower judge's ruling that found that the constitutional amendment did guarantee that patients should be able to smoke their treatment. Now, the constitutional amendment does not specifically say that patients should be allowed to smoke medical marijuana, but it says that the advocates for this say that it was, including the lawyers representing the plaintiffs in the case, say that it's implied. And one of the reasons they say it's implied is there's a section of the constitutional amendment that says that that gives the state the power to ban smoking in public places. So therefore, part of their argument is if the state can ban it in public places, that obviously means that it's permitted in private places.
All right, let's talk about some of the central characters in this case. There's the Orlando trial attorney, John Morgan, who's been essential in part in getting medical marijuana from the beginning. But what's his role right now?
Well, I just spoke with him on Friday. Of course, as you mentioned, John Morgan spent somewhere in the neighborhood of $8 million of his own money to get what was known as Amendment 2 passed in 2016. If you remember, the first version of that failed to capture the 60% majority of voters needed to pass. So they went back in 2016 and it did pass overwhelmingly. Now, he is saying that he told me the other day that he can unfold, he doesn't have to unfold his wallet, he can unfold his megaphone. And that is, as they say in the commercial, priceless, because he is such a well-known guy and he's so quotable. And he says that he thinks that the medical marijuana companies that are already doing business here in Florida or want to do business here in Florida, they should be the ones and they should be willing, and he believes they will be willing, to spend what he estimates will be about $5 or $6 million to get it on the ballot and passed in 2020.
Let's talk about one of the plaintiffs, Kathy Jordan. Who is she? What's her role in this?
Kathy Jordan is, I've referred to her as kind of a rock star in the world of cannabis. She grows her own medical marijuana. She is a patient who has ALS, or better known, I guess, as Lou Gehrig's disease. And she's had that for 30 years. And her doctors told her right after she was diagnosed with this disease that she could expect to live for about 4 or 5 years. She started smoking marijuana as a way of treating some of the very, very life-threatening symptoms of Lou Gehrig's. And one of those is that you could run the risk of drowning in your own drool or cough, or in the phlegm that builds up in your lungs. And so smoking marijuana, if people are familiar with the symptom known as dry mouth, that helps to dry up some of that excess saliva she has. And also when she smokes a joint in the morning, she coughs, and that helps her to clear out the phlegm that's accumulated in her lungs.
But the court recently, the recent decision, basically the court saying that they didn't make their case that it was imperative that she have this.
That's right. And I think that one of the arguments could be that they didn't make the case that she would suffer what the court calls irreparable harm. And one of the arguments, I guess, that you could say is, well, she's already using it. She grows her own. She's using it every day. So she's not prevented from accessing it. There is another patient and another plaintiff who's HIV positive who wants to use to smoke marijuana to treat pain associated with neuralgia that she has from being HIV positive. And they also said that she didn't prove that she didn't demonstrate that she would suffer irreparable harm to let this stay in place while this case works its way through the court system. Case is still alive. I think it's important for folks to know that this case is still, that they haven't, no court yet has ruled on the merits, the underlying merits of the case. And so that's what will continue to play out.
All right. And just, you know what, let's go back real quickly. Does the law explicitly say medical marijuana cannot be smoked?
No. The constitutional amendment relies on a 2014 definition in state law of marijuana, which includes, quote, all parts of any plant of the genus cannabis, whether growing or not. That includes, in my explanation here now, that includes whole flower marijuana, which is used for smoking. The amendment also allows the state to ban smoking of marijuana in public places, which the authors and John Morgan say implies that it could be smoked in private. The plaintiffs also rely on an analysis of intent of the amendment, which was published prior to the election and disseminated broadly to the media and to the public, in which they say that it is that the intent is to allow it to be smoked. So it doesn't specifically say you can smoke it, and it doesn't specifically say you can't smoke it.
All right. Is John Morgan, he's argued the case over smokable medical marijuana is going to the Supreme Court. Is that possible?
It will go to the Supreme Court, yes. I mean, that's where it will ultimately be decided. I doubt seriously that the state, after fighting this far, will give it up and roll over and not. If they lose, they will go to the Supreme Court. Clearly, if the plaintiffs lose, they'll go to the Supreme Court. The First District Court of Appeal is pretty conservative, so I won't try to venture a guess as to how they will rule on the case, but everyone who's involved in this it expects it to go to the Supreme Court.
We're speaking with Derek Kam, senior writer for the News Service Florida, who's joining us via Skype. We're looking at the ongoing legal battles over medical marijuana in the Sunshine State. It's legal here, but should people be able to smoke it? And of course, I mean, the business is growing, but really, what are the pressing issues that's keeping it from expanding, maybe perhaps the way that voters we're hoping for. Who qualifies right now, Cam? Who qualifies, who qualifies for medical marijuana use?
There's about 100,000 patients right now who are in a statewide database. There's a variety of what they call debilitating conditions that a doctor can order medical marijuana as a treatment for. One of them is ALS or Lou Gehrig's disease, Parkinson's, cancer. I won't be able to rattle them all off, but PTSD is one, glaucoma is another, epilepsy is another. And so
there's a long list. Do insurance companies cover? They don't.
No, they do not. And that's been part of it. That has provided a problem for us in some regards, because also it is still illegal. It's a Schedule I. Marijuana is a Schedule I drug under federal law. And so the banking part of this has been problematic. Some of these dispensaries where patients can go to obtain their medical marijuana treatment have ATMs in the actual dispensaries, because it's difficult to get banks to support this activity since it is still illegal under federal law.
And I was just going to jump in on that. Is of course the use of marijuana is illegal federally. Has the use of medical marijuana affected users with their jobs that require background checks, drug testing, or receive federal benefits?
I haven't heard of those kinds of complaints yet. I do know, this is sort of an aside, I do know that there is concern about impaired driving because they don't really have an adequate test to see how, if people, like, they don't have something that you can blow into like they do for alcohol. So it's hard to see how much THC you have in your system, if you've just inhaled it or ingested it, or because it stays in the bloodstream longer. So how are they going to deal with that? It's still, companies still have discretion over not allowing someone to use it in the workplace. So I haven't been contacted by anyone who's had a problem, but I do know just anecdotally of a few folks who have quit their jobs or taken other jobs who are using this as a treatment, and they just did not want to have to undergo the drug screening. They knew they wouldn't be able to pass it, and so they've gone to work for smaller companies or for themselves to avoid having to undergo those drug tests.
As I mentioned, the business is growing. There is obviously, there are companies forming or even companies from out of state that are getting ready or trying to jump into the Florida market. Right now, who can grow medical marijuana?
Right now we have 13 licensed medical marijuana operators in Florida, and there will be a handful more under state law. There's a fight over who gets the licenses, and that's always, they're very lucrative. I just wrote a story a couple weeks ago about a company called MedMen. I always want to call them Mad Men, but it's MedMen. And they're out of California, and they paid $53 million to buy essentially the operations of one of the operators here in Florida. So when I was listening to their call with analysts the next day, they really are banking, and many of these investors are banking on ultimately the state approving adult use, recreational. That's what's going to be the biggest, the most lucrative market in Florida, with, the third largest state in the country. A lot of baby boomers who grew up smoking weed, and a lot of veterans who are turning to or hoping to use smokable marijuana as a way of treating PTSD.
All right, let's talk about politics, because, of course, it is an election year. How have we seen this issue of medical marijuana play out in this race for U.S. Senate between Governor Rick Scott and incumbent Bill Nelson?
Well, you know, John Morgan has been saying that this is going to be the kiss of death for Rick Scott, who was in the Navy and is always seen with wearing this Navy hat when he's out in public. And he thinks that it's going to be an issue that's going to galvanize veterans because the governor has opposed the smoking. It's his administration, mind you, that has been fighting this in court for so long. And I pushed Senator Nelson's folks to get me a response from him a couple weeks ago. Did he support smoking? Did he not support smoking? It took a couple days for him to come out strongly supporting smokable marijuana if a patient's doctor recommends it. You know, recreational, I'm not so sure that's going to be an issue in this election. And I don't know that, you know, I don't think that it's going to be a major issue in Florida, except for people who feel really strongly in favor of it. I do think that in Florida, though, we do tend to have very tight races. And if you have an issue that can provide a bump and move the needle just a little bit for a candidate, then obviously that would be an advantage. And I would think that the candidate that it would benefit would be Senator Nelson supporting smokable marijuana for vets, for sick patients. I just don't see it. You know, I don't see more than a very tiny bump unless folks really get out there and decide they're going to spend money to make it an issue.
And do you see it as an issue that'll come up in the campaign for governor, especially as we approach the primaries?
Now, it has come up as an issue for governor. All of the candidates, the Republicans and the Democrats, have all said that they come out allowing patients to smoke marijuana if their doctors recommend it. Most of them have come out in favor. The Democrats mostly have come out in favor of recreational marijuana. Gwen Graham, I think, has said, you know, let it go to the voters, but I don't want to mischaracterize what she has said, but Adam Putnam, Agriculture Commissioner Adam Putnam, has said that he doesn't support recreational, and I'm not sure where Ron DeSantis is. I should know this. I apologize. I have written about it. I just don't see this as, you know, I just don't see this as a make or break issue for any campaign in the November election. I just think that people are running, you know, people are care more about pocketbook issues right now, to the extent that they're, you know, they care about guns, they care about health care, they care about the economy and jobs. And I'm not saying, please don't misunderstand me, listeners. I understand that marijuana, and particularly medical marijuana, is very important to many, many people. I just don't know that it's an issue that's going to get voters to the ballot boxes in November.
Just real briefly, in 30 seconds or less, because you brought it up a couple of times, the question about recreational marijuana. Is it just inevitable, like other states, that Florida voters will want basically marijuana to be legal in the state? And do you think it'll happen anytime soon?
I think it'll be, they'll get it on the 2020 ballot. And if they have enough money behind it, they can probably get it passed. I think, like everywhere, like in Florida, as across the country, I predict, not just Derek Ham, but many people do predict that eventually marijuana will be legalized. You know, I think it'll take the more people who invest in this, and we are getting more and more traditional type investors in this industry. It's a gazillion dollar industry nationally. Canada is very heavily involved in it because The banking issues are easier to do there. So I think it's going to eventually be, yes, I think Florida will eventually legalize recreational. Do I think it will be in 2 years? They'll have their work cut out for them, and it will cost a lot of money. I think it'll cost more than the $5 or $6 million that John Morgan says it'll cost.
Derek Hem, senior writer for News Service Florida, joining us via Skype, talking about medical marijuana and its legal battle. The legal battles right now over smokable marijuana, medical marijuana, and where is that going to go? And where is this issue going to go in this upcoming election season? Derek, thank you so much for the time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
We also wanted to mention real quickly that we did look up, and Congressman DeSantis is against recreational marijuana, but is for medicinal marijuana. So hopefully we will get him on the show and we'll ask him directly what he thinks about that. We also did start a poll, by the way, on our Facebook, WLRN Sundial. Should the state of Florida allow smokable medical marijuana? We'd love to hear your thoughts on that. All right, still to come, we're going to talk to the folks who want to build a massive pedestrian path along the water in Miami. Is it a good idea? That's up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, many people tend to think of Miami as a car-dominant, traffic-heavy metropolis. But the city is increasingly becoming pedestrian-friendly. It's been ranked in the top 10 cities nationwide for walkability based on various metrics, proximity, public transit, sidewalks, and more. Yeah, we're talking about Miami. An ongoing project by the Related Group and Downtown Development Authority seeks to expand upon the city's pedestrian options and provide a unique public space. The proposed Biscayne Line would be a path along Biscayne Bay that stretches from Brickell to the Design District. Now, portions of the line have already been built, but both groups are facing pushback from some members of the City Commission to connect all of it. The argument continues over funding priorities, sea level rise resiliency, and the impact it's going to have on the high-value condos along the water. We talk with Commissioner Ken Russell of District 2, who's also the head of the Downtown Development Authority, and Carlos Rosso, the president of the Related Group.
Biscayne Line is a public walkway all the way from downtown Miami, from Brickell, to the Design District. It's public access for everybody in the city of Miami to the waterfront in Miami.
Where did the idea come from?
The idea came from a regulation that exists already in the code of Miami, that any developer that develops property on Biscayne Bay needs to leave the first 50 feet as public access to the waterfront. We've done a lot of projects in Edgewater, and we've built pieces of Biscayne Line.
You've already started to build some of it.
Yes.
You know what? Did you compare this to the New York City project that they have there, the High Line? Have you compared it to that?
Yeah, we think at Related that more than building just buildings, you know, we are trying to improve Miami as a city as a whole. And one of the most important things for cities is public spaces to give people public access to different features of the city. In this particular case, it's Biscayne Bay. And yes, we compared it to the High Line in New York and the Beltline in Atlanta.
And these are elevated walkways.
Not necessarily elevated. Beltline.
Well, the High Line is an elevated walkway.
Yeah, the High Line, yes. The Beltline in Atlanta is at grade. It's a walkway which now I think it's already 4 miles long, and has proven an instant success for the city.
So, what do you picture in the height and the width and the size of this walkway? Again, just to get an idea of what we're going to be seeing.
It's a walkway that probably has around 20 feet. In width, and that connects all the waterfront properties, passes in front of all the properties on Biscayne Bay.
Commissioner Russell, any project like this, it's an ambitious project, but any project like this, we have to talk about finance. How does this get financed?
Well, it has to get financed. It has to get done. And any commissioner or city official is only here for 4 to 8 years. For me, this is something that I want to see finished before I leave. You know, it started legislatively that it's financed on the shoulders of development. And this was passed in our charter back in 1979. There was an attorney who was an advocate named Dan Paul. And he helped craft the amendment to our charter that would force development to give this 50-foot setback to the public. And the idea was, instead of private waterfronts for the city just, you know, lining up the entire coastline, that all of the waterfront belongs to the public and that everyone should have access. This was a great notion, and it passed primarily on the idea that development would pay for it as it went along. But the legislation had flaws. As you can see, since 1979, it's not complete. And we found about 9 missing places, missing teeth in the smile, if you will, that make this Baywalk completely ineffective, because if there's, it's only as strong as its weakest link. So I'm ready to bring legislation that'll allow us to finish it now, and I don't think we should be waiting.
So the latest proposal for the City Commission is a $25 million bond to finance the project? Finance the rest of this.
Right. So first it needs the legislation, then it needs the financing. And the legislative piece that is needed is to allow the city to invest in it at all, because this is private property, and the city technically cannot expend on private property. So the legislation I'm looking for would allow the city to invest up front, but what triggers the development, the developers to actually build this, is their actual construction, their permitting. And if they're land banking for years or decades, they're never under the requirement to build. So what I'd like to do is to see the city be able to build this up front, pay for it up front, and be reimbursed by the developers as they trigger their need and their responsibility.
So obviously there's been some opposition on this. Commissioners Carollo and Reyes argue that that's money that could be used for affordable housing. So they want to block it. But, you know, why would the Biscayne Line be a greater asset to the city than what they're arguing for?
Well, this isn't an either-or situation. I mean, affordable housing is a major crisis we have in the city. All 5 commissioners talk about it at every single meeting. Yet, sea level rise and the issues of storm surge, as we saw in Hurricane Irma last year, is also a very critical thing that we need to confront. Now, our front line on storm surge is our bayfront, our Baywalk, our Biscayne Line. And so as we build this this seawall, this walkway, we can also fortify it in the best possible way for storm surge and sea level rise. So I think they're two different conversations that don't necessarily need to, oppose each other. We can do both. And it's not an either or situation. The bond that we passed is $400 million. Half of it is meant for sea level rise mitigation. It can't be used for affordable housing. And so that bond has very specific buckets. $100 million of it is for affordable housing. So really, this isn't an either-or conversation.
All right, so I want to ask you about that resilience, the resiliency of this project to sea level rise. But just real quickly, Commissioner Russell, one more time, though, is that you're saying you want the city to pay this up front and then later get all that reimbursed by the private owners?
Yes, in full.
Do you think right now that you have support for that?
Well, that remains to be seen by the City Commission. I believe, once we give this its day in court, we're going to see that we're all on the same side of this, because this is transformational for the city. I believe the misconception came about with regard to who this sidewalk would belong to. And it's not just a sidewalk for the buildings that are on the water. This is to give the rest of the city access to our water. And so that means all of the commissioners should care about something like this. And all the greatest cities in the world that have waterfront have access to their waterfront and invest in it and give it back to the people. And so this really isn't about, catering to the wealthy, for example. This is about improving the city as a whole, and I believe they'll all be on board with that.
And that's an interesting point, too. All right, I want a lot of things to get to, but Mr. Rosso, let's ask, coming back to the idea of sea level rise, resilience, the issues that we face here in the city, how would this be resilient to sea level rise? And I mean, again, going back to its construction, how does it protect us from that problem?
First of all, the new code in construction obliges all the developers to build their new buildings a lot higher than the old buildings. This has already been done in some other parts of Miami. South of Fifth, for example, is an example. All the projects on South of Fifth had to leave a space in front of them for public access, connecting from Icon South Beach all the way to the South Point Park in the city of Miami Beach. Created incredible amounts of tax revenue for the city, created incredible amounts of public access to the waterfront and protected the end of South of Fifth in cases of surges or water elevation issues. So yes, both of these issues, all these issues can be tackled together. Resiliency, protecting the edge of Biscayne Bay, and at the same time creating more taxes and more public access for everybody in Miami.
So besides the commissioners who are not on board, have you received any pushback from the residents, the condo associations, along that pathway?
Again, you know, I think for old buildings in Biscayne, on Biscayne, you know, we need to sit down with them and explain them exactly how we are going to breach these small properties that are still undeveloped in that area of Edgewater. But I think it's a win-win for all the owners. Again, there's a misconception that public space lowers the price of your unit if it is in front of your unit. It's exactly the opposite. If you really understand how public space works in real estate, you know, the more public space and the more public can walk in front of your condos or your units, the more desirable your condo becomes and the more expensive it is. Just think about any public space in the world, whether it is Central Park in New York, whether it's a great avenue, Champs-Élysées, the more public space and the more public has access for the spaces, your unit becomes more desirable. So that's the conversation that we need to have with some of these old buildings in Edgewater, which at the same time, our buildings are going to eventually be redeveloped.
We are talking with Commissioner Ken Russell of District 2, also Carlos Rosso, the president of the Related Group. We're talking about this idea, this project for a walkway, a pathway along the waterway, stretching pretty much a lot of downtown Miami. The Biscayne Line is what they would call it, a path along Biscayne Bay that stretches from Brickell to the northern tip of Edgewater, and looking to see if they can build it, is there support for it, how many people would use it, and of course, paying for it. Talking about, Commissioner, the Downtown Development Authority recently released its report on the demographics of Miami. What do we know about how the population has changed over the last few years, and do we know that there is a demand for this? Do we know that this is, look, the people who live along the water, yes, will likely use it, but do we know that it will be for more than just those folks?
Absolutely. And downtown in Brickell is nothing like what it was 10 years ago. This isn't a financial district. This is a family district. And what we're finding the need for is to service those families, and that's what's bringing value to downtown in Brickell and the rest of the city. So where at the Downtown Development Authority, maybe years ago, we concentrated on the development of the buildings, now we're concentrating on the spaces in between. And that's where the people want to activate and be. And so that's the important part. That's a big change.
Do we have any studies or any information that tells us that this also alleviates traffic in any way? Do we know?
Well, but from a quantifiable perspective, no. What we've got here is examples of other cities. And, you know, when you've got a connected area that's for pedestrian, that's for cycling, it's not just for exercise. You know, you start to connect the city in a way that gives people choices to get around instead of getting into their car. And that's very important. And so as, you know, I've really pushed the DDA, the Downtown Development Authority, to prioritize this Baywalk, this Biscayne Line, and to get a movement around it so that it belongs to the public and not to the city or to the development. And so through the charrettes and through the group meetings and, you know, bringing on design firms to really study what the people want there to be, what do they want it to look like, what do they want to do there, what would they want it to be, there is tremendous public support for this.
Even for all the complaining that we hear about traffic in Miami, the city itself has become more walkable. Looking at the metrics, the city itself is actually climbing on the list of most walkable cities. But this really question for both of you, is Miami really trying to become a more walkable city? Do you agree with the sentiment that, you know, we're trying to achieve that, or do you believe that more could be done to make it more walkable? Does this add to that? Carlos?
I think Miami is definitely becoming more walkable, and it's becoming more walkable because it's becoming more denser. So the density will bring walkability just as a matter of, as a natural result.
And I didn't add to that is the fact that, you know, that, you know, we're used to people in South Florida just want to get in their cars. Do you think people are wanting to get out of their cars? Are they getting out of their cars?
I think definitely people want to get out of their cars. You know, if you see places like Brickell, in the first phase of projects in Brickell, when we developed nearly 20,000 condos in the previous cycles, you know, finally, Swire at a certain point came to us and said, thank you very much for putting so many people around Brickell. Now we can build a shopping center in Brickell. And you don't have to go anymore. If you live in Brickell, you don't need to take your car anymore to Dateland or to Aventura. You go to Brickell City Center and you have everything there. And you go today to the Apple Store in Brickell City Center, and there's more people in the Apple Store of Brickell City Center than the Apple Store of Lincoln Road. Part of our vision for Miami is, including Biscayne Line, another big idea that we have is to convert South Miami Avenue into the new pedestrian street of Brickell. Brickell deserves, at this point, with the density that it already has, its own Lincoln Road. We want to try and test an idea on Saturdays and Sundays, Friday nights to Saturday nights, to close South Miami Avenue from 8th Street to 14th Street, create our own piece of pedestrian street in the middle of Brickell. We think that ideas like this, with the density that we are already seeing being developed in Brickell, are going to make Miami even more attractive as a city as a whole.
Do you think this could be done when? In 10, 15 years? How long is it going to take?
I think it's going to be done a lot faster. Obviously, some properties are going to be developed when the market comes back. You know, the markets right now, it's in at a pause. But this property is very valuable. This is the most valuable property the city of Miami has in front of the water.
Commissioner, you said you still have to create legislation to take that next step. When do you think you could bring that to a vote?
I'll be doing it this year for sure, and I'm counting on my fellow commissioners. I really believe once they see all sides of this discussion that this is a win-win for the city. Now that we've created the bond itself, this won't be out of pocket for the city. This is something that we need to do is to shore up our shoreline from a safety perspective. All of the worst breaches that we had in Hurricane Irma that flooded Brickell and the other areas were the sections of the Baywalk that have not yet been elevated. And so where you see that the Biscayne Line has been put in place, we have a higher seawall there. We have more protection. And where we don't, the water came in and it flooded the streets. This is something we need to do and invest in. And so the legislation, the way it's going to be written, is very good for the city. And it's not going to be an out-of-pocket from our general fund. It's going to be very attractive to the developers to allow us to invest up front now, because it's going to increase the value of their properties. But also what they have to reimburse us when they do trigger their responsibility is only the portion that we've spent out of pocket. And we as a city can apply for grants that they otherwise wouldn't be able to. Florida Inland Navigation District could provide 50% of the funding potentially, as their mission is to increase waterfront activation and access to the waterfront. And so when that developer later develops that property and they pay us back as a city, they may get a half price deal on it, but we as a city will get back everything that we spend on it.
That was Commissioner Ken Russell representing Miami's District 2 and Carlos Rosso, president of the related group. They're behind the proposed Biscayne Line, a public walkway along Miami's waterfront stretching from the Design District to Brickell. You can see photos of the project on our website, WLRN.org. Also, find us on Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Let us know. What do you think? Is that a good idea? Or do you think it's absolutely horrible? We'd like to hear your thoughts. Well, still to come, we'll learn about a program that connects successful artists with student artists to teach them about making a career out of their passion. That's next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, high schoolers throughout South Florida are continuing their political activism following the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas. Some are choosing to march and get out the vote, like those leading the Road to Change tour, while some are taking a unique approach to the issue of gun violence in an art exhibition. A select group of high schoolers from different schools across Miami-Dade County are part of the Locus Project's month-long intensive program called Locus Art Builders. Now, over the course of the program, the students learn from art professionals across Miami and eventually develop their own exhibition. This Saturday, the students will present Just Another Day in the professional studio space in Locus Galleries. Monica Lopez de Victor is one of the mentors leading the program and has been doing so for 8 years. Monica, great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Also joining us are two of the student artists, Adrienne Cover from Michael M. Kropp Senior High School. Adrienne, welcome.
Hi. Thank you.
Oh, great to have you. Also joining us is Sarah Leva. I knew I was practicing it.
It's okay.
From Design and Architecture Senior High School. It is a pleasure to have all
Thank
of you,
you
here.
So much. Thank you.
Monica, real quickly, start with you. Why did the students want to focus on the issue of gun violence for this exhibit?
Well, that's, I'd say, where they kind of had developed their ideas into, and I wouldn't say it stayed there. It's still progressed and progressing as far as concepts. What would you guys say it is progressed to now?
Well, eventually it kind of led to normalization of violence, especially with our generation specifically, with all the shootings that have been going on. There have been about 30, I believe. And in 2018, we're not even halfway through the year. And I think that it's getting more and more normal. When I first heard about Parkland, I was kind of like, oh, okay. It didn't shock me. It didn't really shake me to the core until I read the details and understood these kids.
So Sarah, for you then, how do you express that as an artist? How do you express that sort of like, wow, okay, another one?
Since it is Just Another Day, which is the name of our exhibition, it's just another day in the life of us, basically, as artists and as teenagers. And I think that by taking a lot of mundane objects and warping them in a way to create an incredibly interesting visual concept for a lot of people to think about, I think that's the way that we're starting to head towards that subject.
And Adrienne, I was curious, you know, what those conversations were like that when you guys were having them as you're developing this project. What was that conversation like?
The conversations were very, because like we said, it's just another day. So these are things that we've talked about, like ever since the Parkland shooting. I've talked about this event so many times. Like even at Locust, we've talked about it. So it's very normal, but it still holds weight. And it is something that still needs to be talked about. Mm-hmm. So I'm really driving this home.
And as an artist though, I mean, just as Sarah was telling us, you know, what are you thinking about, you know, in the way you're going to express your emotions, your thoughts on this issue visually?
Mm-hmm. So like Sarah said, we're taking very like everyday objects and forcing them into these big, very heavy pieces, because the title Just Another Day, it disarms you. Before you're going to walk into this show, you're going to feel regular, but when you walk in, you're going to feel the weight of the topic. That's what we're trying to drive home.
Monica, you've been part of the Locust membership program or mentorship program since the inception, 8 years ago now.
Yeah, I developed it with the former director of Locust Projects, and it's been a dream of mine to be able to do this with high school students, basically.
Why did you want to do it? What was the inspiration? What was the reason?
There was nothing like it at all, especially at that time. And as a creator myself, as an artist, I wish I knew a lot of the things that I know now or that's accessible now. And so I really wanted to be able to empower the next wave of Miami artists.
And remind people of how the program works, because you bring these young artists in, but you want to connect them to artists who are already out there who are making a living.
Yeah, so we have it's a 4 week long summer art initiative for teens, where they have to apply to be able to get in, and then we select between 18 and 25 students, and they're always usually from different schools, and Locust has always been supportive of artists, any type, you know, and so to be able to include teenagers and what they're going through and what they're thinking is just really empowering and very exciting.
And it's not just conversations about the craft,
right?
Because that's one thing, but
right.
it's other.
So yeah, we basically trying to teach them how to hustle.
because you're going to have to hustle.
Yeah, because the art industry is not the easiest. I mean, it can be very easy and it's very exciting, but you got to really work for it. And, you know, we bring in other speakers. We take them to places that can help them connect the dots between basically where they are right now in high school and then kind of their dream life goals. And
yeah.
To help them see, you know, that it's not always a straight line or a straight path.
All right, Adrienne and Sarah, I mean, we were joking about this earlier. I mean, I as I told you, I started college as an art major. Thought I was going to be an artist. Mm-hmm. I always kept hearing the same thing over and over, though. It's you know, the same advice, like, oh, you're going to be an artist. Get a day job. You're going to starve. You're going to be a starving artist. Is that still the mantra? Is that what people tell you?
Oh, yeah, me personally. My aunt tells it to me all the time.
It's always great when the family does it, right? Like, I know what that's like, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but what do you do when you hear that? What do you think?
I mean, it's expected. But I mean, me personally, like, I always have it in my head, like, I don't really care if I actually do end up starving. I don't think I'm going to starve because art is a hustle. There's so many things you can do. But I mean, I guess if I actually do starve, I'm still happy with what I do.
Yeah. You know what, for both of you, though, real quickly, is tell me about one moment, maybe one of the artists you met or one of the conversations that you had that really stood out for you. Like, wow, that's something I didn't think about that is really helping you right now. Adrienne, what is that moment?
Okay, I'm so sorry, I don't remember his name, but he basically created Logic Art. Is that what
Leo?
Leo. He, I don't know, he's so inspiring because he's basically like me. He's like this, he started out as this punk kid. He was in a band. He toured across the whole United States. But then, like, he owns this huge company now that does so much for, like, the art world. And I think one piece of advice he told us was don't veer off. Don't do odd jobs too often, you know? Like, know what you're going to do, know what path you're on. You can do an odd job here and there, but don't go too far out because that's still your dream and it still matters to you.
All right. Sarah, what about you? What's a moment, a piece of advice or something you gained?
There was a costume designer who actually came. She does performance art.
Jen Clay?
Yes. She was absolutely incredible, the amount of detail that she puts into her work. And I want to be a fashion or costume designer, both if I can. But just, she was so passionate and loved her craft so much that it really, it made me hone in on it and focus even more on that, and allowed me to consider performance art as well, and how impactful or impacting that could be to a viewer. And she let us try on the suit, which was really, really cool. So we got to see from her eyes, quite literally. And I just got transported into an entirely different universe when she came.
Now, they talk about hustle. So it's the hustle. Something I also mentioned to you is that, you know, not to sound like the old man here, but you guys are the you know, in the world you live in today, I mean, it's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, yeah. Pinterest. You have social media. Is there a tool for you that a lot of us other artists didn't have? But what did you learn about the hustle using the digital media aspect? You know, what, how do you do that now today?
I actually don't have any social media. Incredible, I know.
Wait a minute, Monica, how's that possible?
It's the next wave, I think, is the anti-technology.
Really?
Possibly.
But can you make it without that today?
Oh, I think so. I mean, if you're involved enough and you're in real life enough, why not?
It's possible.
I'm not
good old school.
Yeah, I'm not anti-technology at all. I haven't really found any need for it. I think that it has been such an influence for artists in this generation because there's so much out there from everywhere, and you can just kind of look at that with just a simple tap, and I think that's absolutely incredible. And I think getting your art out there through that does make things a lot more convenient. But
Adrienne, what about you?
I mean,
are you up there on digital? Are you out there? You think that's the best tool?
Not really.
No? Wow.
Really.
All right. Well, no. Listen, you're going old school. You're talking my language. All right. I'm all for it. Real quickly for the show, for this exhibit. I mean, because we got a little taste of it. Adrienne said it's going to be heavy, but I mean, how would you describe it real quickly, Monica?
Well, a lot of different of the artists, the students in the group have collaborated and they're building different pieces. So it's still underway. And right now we have kind of the crunch week of getting the last pieces out. But I know a bunch of the pieces have already touched me. So I'm very curious to see how it all does come together. Because another mentor artist Francesco Locastro does it with me, and we both are really just trying to pull out of them whatever it is that they want to communicate as a collective group, as well as individual artists. And it just goes right along with Locust Project's kind of ideas and mission. It's the longest running alternative art space, you know, started by artists, it's for artists.
How is this growing, this program growing? And what do you think, you know, how much more is it going to evolve, say, for the next group?
I think it grows and evolves every single year, because their generation especially, it changes over so quickly. Like this year we had this kind of concept suddenly be dumped on them, you know, as far as the world, what's happening. And so it was very heavy for them, you know, already. And heavy meaning good, though, as well, because it's something that was just very impacting as far as ideas.
And Sarah and Adrian, I wanted to hear from you. If you were to talk to another student right now who's thinking maybe about applying, what do you tell them? Why they should?
Absolutely.
Okay, but why? Okay. Tell me why.
You are given the freedom to come up with your own concept. You're allowed to work with other students your age who do also art, and you're given all these tools and resources and knowledge, and meeting all these people in the art world locally.
It would be a missed opportunity if you didn't.
Definitely.
Adrienne, what would you tell them?
Just do it, just in case. I feel like in my life I've opted out of a lot of opportunities, but like this is something, because of me just doing it and trying, I actually got it. Like this is, for example, like something as little as this, I've never used a drill in my entire life. To be like, I get to do so many things. It's such a free and open space. I am creating, I've never created pieces so big.
Don't miss out on the opportunity, basically, is what they're saying.
Yes.
Adrienne Cover, Sarah Leyva, both students in this program. And also we heard from Monica Lopez Victor, again, at the Locust Art Builders. Go to the website, check out more on it. Thank you so much. Best to all of you as you move forward.
Thank you so much. Saturday, come to the show.
Saturday. We'll have
open
that
to the public.
We'll have that information up on our website. I'm Luis Hernandez. That's the program. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.